interest in this subject. We're going to start today with a presentation generally from our legislative revenue officer, Paul Warner, who is providing today, at the request of the chairman and other interest groups, general information about possible, and let me highlight, possible revenue sources that could be examined as a possibility for funding a compensation fund for the payment of retroactive claims. So based on that, I asked Mr. Warner, along with some of the other interest groups on this issue, to consider various options that might have a nexus relationship in some way to development, and these are at least three possible ideas. I welcome the committee and the public's input on these, and if they've got ways to make them better or ideas of their own, certainly I believe this committee would be interested in hearing them. So with that, I will turn the time over to Mr. Warner, our legislative revenue officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I would emphasize that, as the Chair has pointed out, there's three options here. This is by no means exhaustive, and there are certainly other possibilities as well, but these are three that have kind of come to the surface in terms of looking at this issue, and really two of them specifically come right from the language of Measure 50 and the exception value involved in Measure 50. But let me just first lay out the objectives as I understand them, talking with the Chair and the Vice Chair, that the goals here, first of all, is to generate sufficient revenue stream to retire a $200 million bond. Now that in and of itself is the $200 million largely depends on how 3998 is ultimately shaped. But just to give you a sense of the numbers on that, the debt retirement for a tax-exempt bond of $200 million over 30 years is about $17 million. The Treasury would recommend that in most cases what investors would expect is what we call 2X coverage, which would be $34 million. In other words, a revenue stream that's twice what you need to meet the bond obligation. So you're looking at a revenue stream of about $34 million to retire this $200 million bond. The other criteria, that's really the adequacy criteria. The other criteria is that there be a link with beneficiaries of land development, so that there be a tie there, so there's a benefit tax element to this, so that the sources of funds have some linkage with the uses of funds. And of course that, as you'll see, as you look at some of these options, will become a matter of degree. The third point is to require some governmental action, some point of taxation or point of transaction in which revenue can be generated. And the fourth criteria is one that I put in on all tax measures as an important policy consideration, and that is to minimize the economic distortions. And here what you're looking at, the broader your base in terms of tax policy, usually the less distortions you have. The more narrow it is, the more you risk changing economic activity, and to an economist, causing inefficiencies in the market system. The options, as I've outlined them here, is the first is to have the broadest option, which is a tax imposed when an assessor deems that a property owner is has done something to the property that requires exception value. And that means that the property is no longer subject to the 3% annual limit under Measure 50. Now, if you look at your third page in your packet, over in the, I've got a page of the Oregon Constitution with Measure 50 in it, and the second column there, it gives the reasons for exception value. And as for this base, what I have done is broke out the top three, which are the property is a new property or new improvements to the property, which is about 76% of exception value over the last couple of years. The second is the property is partitioned or subdivided, And third, the property is rezoned and used consistently with that rezoning. So those are the three elements that I've included in that base. And if you look on the next page, the option A there, that has the numbers on it, you can see what I've estimated as a revenue stream from this base beginning in 2002-03 with a $5 per thousand one-time charge on that exception value. And I've assumed that that grows 2% a year, so that over 20 years it would be $57 million annually. Now let me say some words of caution about exception value. The first is that when Measure 50 was enacted in 1997, one of the primary concern of the assessors was getting the property on the roll and getting the right taxes tax bills out to individuals. It was not to set up a data gathering system that would accurately reflect all of these different types of exception value. So we have found, and certainly the Department of Revenue has found, that there are inconsistencies in the data, that the assessor, the county assessor offices don't treat all exception value the same. We'll particularly see this in the case of rezoning. In our database, we have a number of counties that have no rezoning, and then we have some counties that have a whole lot. And that indicates to us that, and likely what's going on is there's an inconsistent categorizing of that data. Again, this is not a criticism of the assessors. Their job was to get the appropriate tax bills out to taxpayers, and there wasn't the time to set up the data system. So that's a word of caution as we look at this data. We have found some inconsistencies in it, and certainly the Department of Revenue is aware of that. So the other point I'd like to make about exception value is that when you think about it, and 76% of the exception value is new property, mostly new construction, you're looking at a pretty volatile revenue stream, much more volatile than the 3% base out there on existing property. So I've kind of masked that in terms of this long-term 2% per year. It looks like you've got a nice steady revenue stream here, and I would be pretty confident that this revenue stream would probably be in 20 years somewhere over $50 million. But it's not going to get there in a smooth pattern. They're going to be down years in recessions where you're going to see the stream decline. So again, that's a reason to have that 2x coverage when you're thinking about bonding, that you have at least a 2-to-1 ratio in meeting that debt requirement need. I have listed here just a few things that I would see as advantages and disadvantages to this kind of an option. Let me just say that what happens is the tax would be triggered when the property owner files a permit, so there needs to be some point there at which the tax would be collected when you file a permit, when you file for a rezone, when you file for a petition or subdivision. I would see that the two major advantages, first of all, it's a pretty broad base, even though it is somewhat volatile because it's largely new construction. It's pretty broad. It's statewide, and you're always going to have some construction activity going on, either replacement or new construction. So it should be able to generate a sufficient revenue stream over time. $5 per thousand is a relatively low rate in terms of influencing economic activity. So you would anticipate that broad base would help you with that. The second is that it does tend to meet the criteria. It is linked, not directly certainly in many cases, but does have some link to land development. And it does require some governmental action. And because of its broader base, it should have economic distortion shouldn't be severe. Now, I turn around on the disadvantage side and say there is a disincentive for new construction here. I mean, when you're putting on an additional $5 per thousand for new construction, you may discourage some construction projects at the margin. And certainly certain types of investment that would be a large initial value where the $5 per thousand could be a significant cost. So I'm sure you'll hear that as a concern about this option. The other disadvantage I have listed there is indirect link to land use beneficiaries, and in a meeting with the chair and the and the vice chair got into talking about my addition on my house, and you know, and my addition on my house triggered an exception value, and I haven't gotten my bill yet from the assessor, but I will be reassessed now to reflect that higher value. You know, was I really a beneficiary of land development as a result of that? It gets a little bit indirect in some cases, and I'm sure you'll hear that argument that this is perhaps not a direct link, as maybe some would think necessary. So I put that as a disadvantage too, that the link is indirect and not as clear in many cases, particularly in the case of residential improvement. The residential improvement needs to be greater than 5% of the value to trigger this exception value. The second option is the B there on the second page, a one-time tax on a narrower base, again drawing on the exception value, a change in property that requires exception value, only limiting it here to the subdivision, partitioning, and rezoning. So it's a more narrow base, really, of option A. And if you look at option B then, which is the next to last page, you see the revenue stream there, and you can see where the exception value is, partitioning and subdivision, the proportion there that I've asked. What I've done on these estimates is take the percentage of exception value from my latest data point, which is a 9900, and use that percent, which is 14%, and assume that stays constant. As I've projected that out, I've assumed that it's 14% subdivision and partition. The rezone, as I said earlier, is particularly tricky because the data looks very inconsistent across the counties. So basically what I did was I threw out one county, Grant County, that had a very high number, which it seemed to me to be a categorization issue, and a number of counties that had zeros values for rezoning, threw those out and took the average of the remainder. And what I found was about 0.5% of exception value was from rezoning. So that's a pretty rough estimate. That's the shakiest part of my data, is on that rezoning. But you can see what the value is there in millions. It's roughly $50 million or so. Starts out at $41 million and then grows 2% a year. The tax rate here, notice that in contrast to over the option A, where it's $5 per thousand, here it's 0.02 or 2%, so four times greater, or $20 per thousand. So one time $20 per thousand exception value. So if you look at that revenue stream, you can see what that looks like. It starts out in 2003 at about $25 million and then slowly grows up to the mid-30s. In terms of the advantages and disadvantages, I would say that it does clearly have a closer link to the beneficiaries of land development than the broader exception value does, because you've got some clear action toward development, either rezone or through partition subdivision. So I think the nexus is tighter, certainly, with this more narrow definition. And it also has a clear link to governmental land use decisions. The government has to act, yes, we're going to rezone this land, it's going to be used in a different way. The disadvantage is, and this is the classic disadvantage in all tax policy, is the more you narrow that base, the higher rate you have to generate to get your adequate revenue stream. And then that leads directly to the second disadvantage, which is you distort economic decisions. So you're imposing a higher cost on a narrower set of economic actions. So here we're talking about 2% of the value of that transaction as a one-time charge, which can be significant in cases of high-valued actions.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Schrader.
Since it takes a while to ramp up to that magical 2x level, is that any way hurt our bonding ability?
The adequacy issue, I think, in option B would be a concern. Yes.
especially given the fact that rezoning is a little sketchy.
Rezoning data is sketchy. Subdivision and partition would also be a volatile revenue stream. Now, keep in mind the numbers I plugged in here in terms of rates can be adjusted. So
yep.
That's another thing you can do. But again, the more you raise that rate, the more you risk economic distortions.
Paul, just out of curiosity, in discussing option B, what is your, your confidence level in, if you were having to apply a confidence level to the three proposals, and I know we haven't got to C yet, so I won't ask you to do C until you talk about it, but as between option A and option B, could you share with me what you think your confidence level is?
Mr. Chair, I'd really divide that question, I guess, into two areas. One is my confidence level is where we are right now, if you had this tax in place right now. My confidence level is, in terms of the question of would you generate, as of 01-02, would you generate $25 million? You know, I would say that we would have to have at least a 10% variation around that in terms of what's taking place right now.
Okay. And is that less or more confidence than in the option A numbers?
The option A, I would have more confidence because I have more confidence in that total number rather than the subdivisions of it in terms of the percentages. The other thing, too, I would point out, Mr. Chair, that the other confidence issue is how confident, even if I'm dead on for where we are in 01-02, would be how confident am I in that 09-10 number I've got here or any of the future numbers. And there, you know, you have to add this yearly fluctuation in there that would add another element to that confidence interval of at least another 10%. So there's going to be a volatility issue.
The other thing I'll point out to the committee before we let him move on to option C and then open it up for further questions is the $200 million number that we sort of threw out as a target was essentially what, at least in my own view and in talking to other people, was the minimal, if we wanted to do it through bonding, would be the minimal amount that you would want to actually bond for. If it was less than $200 million, it would almost be not worth running the bond and trying to come up with at least a set fund of money at a given point in time. And I know certain people who have advocated for the option B component have suggested that you just not bond at all, that you don't use the money for bonding, that you just use it as a steady stream and you pay the claims as the money rolls in, and if there isn't money, then you wait until the next cycle to determine whether there's money. So the bonding piece of this is not mandatory under any of these ideas, but one of the ideas was to figure out what kind of revenue stream you could have that would actually generate a $200 million bond fund, and it was just determined $200 million because if it was less than that, it almost wasn't worth going through the cycle of trying to do the bond. And I think most of us are confident, even though we have very little data about what the actual claims experience will be, that I think most people believe that the claims experience would exceed $200 million. And so it was sort of a, let's just pick $200 million as the minimum amount that we would want to bond if we were going to try to meet that level of claims experience. So it was just a number for demonstration purposes in this presentation.
Do you want to go on to option C, Paul?
Mr. Chair, if I could add something, too, on the bonding issue, and if you choose to go down that road and start looking at some of the details there, I know the Treasury would suggest some things that would make those bonds more saleable, such as having the moral backing, if not the legal backing, of the state government, so that there would be some implied sense of responsibility that there would be efforts to this revenue source turned out to be inadequate to find other revenue, and also to make the revenue stream, revenue bonds that would, and this tax source is being a lien on property rather than on individuals, like a property tax. So that would be, those would be the kinds of things you could do to make the bonds more attractive or make investors more comfortable and willing to purchase the bonds.
Okay, thank you.
The last option here is a little different. This is reduce the discount rate, and this really came from the vice chair and talking with him and about this revenue stream. And we've looked at it somewhat, And basically what we found is that over the last few years, this 3% discount that is allowed for early payment of property taxes, and I'm sure you're all familiar with that with your property tax statement, that you do get a 3% discount if they're paid by a certain date, that the, when we look at the property tax data, there is a an estimated amount of that credit. And if you look on the last page there, under option C, you can see what that's been over the last 3 years. It's been, last year it was $68.9 million. So a significant amount of revenue reduction because of the 3% discount. Now what I've done here for 0102 is I've just assumed that that discount rate is lowered to 1.5%, and then you've got basically half the revenue. So the two columns there, the first column is no discount, and then you would generate that revenue stream that currently what the discount rate reduces revenue by, and then I'd take cutting that in half. I haven't assumed any behavioral changes here. There may be some change, and certainly people would tend to pay their property taxes a little later, so there may be some cash flow issues to consider for the counties. But in terms of that general revenue stream, as you're looking out over 20 years, I doubt if you would see significant changes in behavior over time. It may be some shifting within a current year, but not shifting between years.
Representative Beck.
Paul, where would that, how would that tax or that funding source be assessed? I mean, where would that money, if we eliminated the 3%, how do we 3% from everybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, that's my last, that's my second disadvantage there. It's not clear to me how that collection mechanism would operate. Clearly, you would have, we do have the data, and we know what those discount rates, I hesitate to use the word cost the counties now, but in terms of their revenue impacts, we know what those are, so the counties themselves could be assessed on what those dollars are and have those sent to the Department of Revenue or some central state source. But it would be indirect, and there would have to be some real thought behind that in terms of how that collection mechanism would work with the counties. In terms of the advantages of that approach, clearly is broad-based. I mean, you're covering a very wide spectrum, and we've got county-level data, and there's a fair amount of revenue generated across all the counties here. So it would definitely be broad-based. And I, you know, as I said, I don't think you're going to see much change in economic behavior as a result of this, and there probably isn't going to be much economic distortions associated with it. The disadvantage, and probably the biggest disadvantage in terms of your policy concerns, is its link to beneficiaries is more indirect than the other two. I think quite clearly that basically you're tying into the property tax payment mechanism now, altering that mechanism, and therefore changing the amount of overall total property tax collections that you would receive, and then taking a proportion of that discount proportion. So it would clearly be less direct, certainly, than B, and then than A as well. So those are the kind of trade-offs that you would be looking at as you consider with those three options.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Schrader.
All three of these require a 3/5 vote. And what are our legal and constitutional issues with pursuing any and all of these?
In terms of the constitutional issues, I think certainly A and B would require some constitutional changes. They would require a referral to modify Measure 50, so they would be seen as taxes on property, and therefore would require some constitutional resolution. C, I don't believe would. I think that would require a fairly straightforward statutory change, and simply eliminating the 3% discount and going through and setting up the mechanism for collecting the revenue that would result from that. So in terms of kind of the pursuing it at the legislative level, C probably is the simplest to do because you could do it statutorily.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
If we were to pursue A and B, besides constitutional problems in terms of voting and that sort of thing, I assume the issue of compression could come into play, so we would probably not want to impose that upon the cities and counties and have to deal with that constitutionally also, eh?
Representative Schrader, a lot of that would depend on how you wrote that resolution. So, you know, if you were going through that process, I would suggest you look seriously at basically setting up something that would be outside the Measure 5 constraints. Otherwise, you're going to get into a very complicated measure.
Right.
And that would certainly be the simplest way to do it.
Further questions for Mr. Warner?
Yeah.
Representative Beck.
Paul, without getting into a whole Measure 50 discussion, help me understand this exception value a little bit more. So on the addition to your house, that triggers a total revaluing of the property, or do you just pay, is it just the value of the increased, you know, the new addition, or is with the case with the rezoning, is it just the increase due to the rezoning that is above the measure, that is above Measure 50, or is the whole thing thrown out and you start from scratch and you have a new real market value if you do anything to improve your property?
Yes, you would have a new maximum assessed value.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the data, there is some increment involved there. For example, on my house, I would have some incremental value that's associated with just the addition itself. What is that worth? How much is it added to the market value of my house? You know, that's where the data gets murky for us in terms of how much of that is what we call net exception value versus how much is what is gross exception value, which would be the whole value of the property. What we have tried to do in this data is try to get at that net. So the way that we've looked at this would be, again, using my addition as an example, this tax would be on that net, the value of my addition only. How much did it add incrementally to the value of the property? But that's where we get back to the data, and we're hesitant that is done on a case-by-case basis, particularly when you have new construction. If you have a vacant lot and you're building a home on it, and then it shows up as exception value, we think in a lot of cases the entire value is put on the exception value list rather than what would be theoretically what we think of as the value of the home minus the bare land as it was in its previous state. So it's more of a data problem than it is in terms of a legal one.
If I can, Mr. Warner, and Representative Beck, you were talking about option A, right?
A and B.
Am I right, though, that as you analyzed this, you sort of took your best estimate at getting to net rather than gross exception value for these numbers?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. When we went through and summed up all the exception value we could get from the Department of Revenue reports from the counties, we found that there was about $13 billion. We have then taken that and narrowed it down to a little over $8 billion. And that's what we have tried to capture, that gross versus net difference, again, recognizing there's some limitations there. What I've done in that option A and that exception value, I've then subtracted out about 9% of that because it's either omitted or what's called other. So the other components under your constitutional reasons for exception value, because I've assumed those wouldn't be part of this base, that something like omitted property would not trigger this tax.
Okay. The other question I had, if were there other questions?
I wanted to ask about other funding sources.
Can we do that after I ask a couple more questions here? I was interested in option B, your comment about high rate increase chances of distorting economic decisions. And as the former state economist, maybe you can enlighten us a little bit about at what level of sensitivity do you think this would have, for example, if we were to do an option B approach, which is very narrow to these partition subdivisions and rezone areas, at this 2% tax rate, do you think that that is going to be a rate that's actually going to drive behavior? And is there any way that we can know historically what the impact might be?
Mr. Chair, that's really, of course, the broader question is the OTM question of tax incidence and what the behavior response is, and this is a...
Those of you who aren't on the Revenue Committee, it's probably only Representative Beck and I who know about OTM. Do you want to just take 2 seconds and tell them what that stands for, Paul?
OTM is the Oregon Tax Incidence Model that tries to build in behavioral responses to tax changes in the economy as a whole. In this area, you know, I think there would be some sensitivity because, you know, it is high valued. I mean, if you're looking at, you know, property running into the millions of dollars and you put on a 2% to that, at the margin, it could have some effect. It could have some timing effect. Will it cause dramatic changes in that behavior? Probably not. I mean, it's, you know, if you increase costs by 1%, you could assume that activity in that area may drop by 1% from what it would have otherwise been. So, you know, those kinds of parameters you're looking at. So you're not looking at a big change, but at the margin you may have some influence on those decisions.
This is obviously, I think, critical to option B, just because of its very narrow base. If it's overly sensitive to the increase, then people don't partition, subdivide, rezone, or at least don't develop, because remember the trigger is the development of the property. And if they don't actually use it for the upzoned, rezoned, or subdivided or partitioned purpose, if they never get to the point of using it, then it never triggers and the tax is never collected. And so you've developed a revenue source that then never gets funded. And I think it's the sensitivity, I think, between those two issues that would be worthy of a little bit more before the committee makes a determination if we were to choose one of these three or other options. Are there other questions about the current options that we've examined? I know you want to talk about other sources. Oh, okay, good. Representative Beck.
Is it safe to assume that, let's say, if we were to look at option B and analyze it in, say, 0.25% realms, would the revenue stream correlate proportionally tax rate by 0.25%? So there's no...
There's no behavioral response built into this. That's correct. It's just directly proportional. But one thing, though, I would suggest that you think about as you structure something like this in the tax versus fee area is to remember that if it's structured as a tax, as a property tax, you know, you're wrestling with a measure 5 and 50, but you also have the advantage of you'd be exporting, you know, 15% of that burden to the federal government through deductibility. So if you can keep it in a tax-deductible form as a property tax, you relieve the tax burden on the individuals, and you export your tax burden to the federal government. So that's a factor to consider as well versus a fee that's not deductible.
Could you walk through how that would work, for example, under the option B scenario, Paul?
Well,
a little hypothetical.
I would think, that, Mr. Chair, that the area where that would really be obvious would be in the option A, where you have individual homeowners with doing something that generates exception value. Then, of course, you have, if it's treated as a property tax, you have something that's deductible on your individual income tax. For businesses that are in option B, it's less important because there'll be businesses that can treat that as a business expense and deduct it. Any state and local fees can be treated as a business expense. So they can use that to deduct from what their tax burden would be.
Representative Beck, you have further questions?
Well, I just want to be in all this puzzle that why we don't have the most logical funding source, which, of course, is real estate transfer tax, and why that's not, wouldn't be part of this discussion other than the obvious political impediments in this building, but trying to do big things. It seems that is the broadest base, the most logical connection, and I'm wondering if you've given any thought to that and maybe could tell 0.5% increase in the real estate transfer tax would yield annually, or do we know that, or could we get that?
Representative Beck, I'm just thinking, I wish I would have brought our
right.
public finance annual
mile,
report.
Right.
I've forgotten what those numbers. We do that estimate yeah. every year, and we tie it to the Washington real estate transfer base. So that would be another option that could be included here, certainly, as certainly tied to real estate and tied to a transaction. I guess the reason why I didn't include it here was it wasn't triggered by some land development issue. It was rather triggered by a transaction. But of course, you could also say that about the 3% discount too, which is a result of just a transaction with the local government. But that's certainly something that we've looked at, and you know, if you want us to look further at that, we'd be happy to do it.
I would. I mean, we have the data. If we're serious about having a funding discussion, I think it absolutely has to be on the table. I'd be curious to, in your analysis, to look at, you know, the broad base element. Of course, not everybody sells property per year, but presumably, at some point, everybody pays if they either sell their property or if they're a renter, they pay that through their rent.
I think you would have probably some of the similar kinds of advantages and disadvantages as you have with the total exception value. It is a broader base. If you're able, allows you to keep the rate lower and therefore not have large economic distortions. On the other hand, your links to the land use beneficiaries are pretty indirect. And real estate transactions are volatile stream. It's broad based, but they're also highly cyclical, moving up and down with a housing cycle.
Just the other question.
Yes, Representative Beck.
I'm wondering if rather than
issuing a large bond at the outset, whether there's a way to structure the funding so that we authorize a large amount, but we issue the bonds in increments, dated annually or biennially to the amount of claims that have been filed, so that we don't, while we the voters could theoretically authorize us to issue $1 billion in bonds, but we may do it in $50 million a year increments. Are there downsides to doing it incrementally like that, or is it best to do it all at once? And do any of those dynamics affect the type of funding sources we use, the type of interest rate we get, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, my advice, and Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, and any, particularly a new revenue source, the longer time you can establish that revenue stream and what it's going to look like, and before you make large commitments in terms of a debt finance out of that stream, the better off you are. So, you know, I would not make large commitments until you had to in terms of your expenditure needs. And if you get that revenue stream in place and it seems pretty consistent, predictable, then, of course, that's going to help you with selling those bonds and identifying that stream as paying them off. So I think that's true of any new revenue source. And I think most of the things you're looking at are going to be new revenue streams in one sense or another.
Further questions? Thank you, Paul. We appreciate you coming up and spending a few minutes with us and for having done these. Again, for the members of the committee that are here, I know Paul has been willing to work with any of the members who want to run some numbers or look at some possible ideas. Similarly, for those of you in the audience, if you've got better ideas or variations of themes of any of the ideas in front of us, I'd encourage that you make those known to a member of the committee so we can ask Mr. Warner to help us gather the data. So thanks again.
Appreciate you willing to do that, Mr. Chair, and anything you want us to to explore in more depth, we're happy to do it.
Because we know that you guys have a lot of time on your hands down there in the revenue office right now. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it. When we adjourned last week, or was it earlier this week, whenever it was, we were actually going through the bill in sort of a section-by-section analysis, just to generally understand the subject matter of the sections of the bill and how they interact. Sue Hanna from Legislative Council is with us, and I think I'd just like to have her take the last little bit of time here we have this evening to just finish at least walking through the sections. Sue, we were on my recollection is we were on section 12, which was the threshold section, which we have decided to essentially skip because I don't think there's anybody who currently supports it as drafted, and we were going to move essentially into the process sections of the bill. So I think it would be helpful maybe if we spent a little bit of time maybe at section, starting at section 13 and then walking through the remainder.
Representative Williams, members of the committee, Sue Hanna from Legislative Council. At section 13.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Schrader.
The section you'd like to skip? May I ask one question on that?
Yeah, sure.
Clarification on section 12, sub 2, sub C. That's page 11, starting in line 6.
Well,
I'm looking
at.
I'm sorry. That's wherever it's supposed to be on the bill. Since I marked up the draft.
That would be page 6. And what subsection?
Subsection 2.
Which would be line 16.
C, I believe. Regular C.
Little C?
Little C.
Line 31.
Line 31.
Line 31.
A new local.
I don't understand that paragraph. We're talking about property restrictions, if you will, that would not be entitled to compensation. So if you could explain why C is not entitled to compensation.
No.
Well, that makes me feel a little better anyway.
Well, I think that's one of the problems we've got with all of Section 12.
Yeah, we're
okay. So then I'll
we're working on that.
Trying to skip that, as you suggested, as very wise of you, sir.
Jenny, do you want to address that? Do you have a comment about how that was at least potentially intended to offer?
Chair Williams, as I understand it, that was put in there as a placeholder to try to figure out what would be restricted. The idea was that if the requirements were clear and objective, they would be subject, if there were existing regulations that were clear and objective, then they would not be subject to a claim. But what the idea was that for things that were vague or not subject to clear interpretation, that would not be exempt.
If I could read you some language that might sound a little clearer, maybe you could tell me if you think it's clear. The new local government land use requirement or amendment to an existing local government land use requirement is required to implement clear and objective a statewide requirement that was adopted prior to the effective date.
That sounds much clearer to me.
Is that better for you?
Sounds much better.
Okay. All right, down to section 13, we're sorting out liability here. We don't know which government entity is going to be liable. This simply sets the process for determining how they pass the claim back and forth to avoid the property owner running around and doing it. Sub 1 is if the state is liable. Sub 2, if Metro is liable. Sub 3, if the local government is liable. Section 14 gets into the amount of compensation. Rumor has reached me that that's the subject of great discussion as well, so I won't go into it in any detail. Sub 2 of 14 is what's commonly known as the toolbox. When the government entity provides compensation, how can they do it, in cash or in a variety of other ways? That's laid out in that section.
Can I ask a question there?
Yes, you may.
Certainly, I would hope, you know, the committee will spend some time on 1A and B. With regard to sub 2, having tried to read this and supposedly being somewhat familiar with some of the contents, what about the thought that if under 2, A and B were the mode of compensation, that they would, that would be decided by the governmental entity, and C and D, however, with little c, little d, would be perhaps negotiated types of arrangements between the prospective claimant and the governmental entity to which the claims are made. In other words, who gets to make that determination as to what form of compensation?
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader, this is all subject to negotiation. It's going to go into a public hearing process, and there'll be a lot of discussion. But in lieu of having, say, a mediated decision or an arbitrated decision, the government entity is going to make the decision in the end. And we move on a little later in the process sections to talk about how that can be negotiated.
Thank you.
If you turn the page 8, first sub 2, you see up there, if we're talking about something like an ordinance that imposes a single restriction, you have a one-year limit in which to file a claim, versus in sub 3, when you personally have received a decision on your permit application, you have 21 days. Sub 4 deals with other processes that may...
Chair, you want to stop and get clarification?
Well, I was back on section 14, actually.
Okay.
Sorry. In little d, sub something or other.
Line 35?
Sub 2, I think. See, I'm working off the wrong draft, because I made all my notes on the
right.
LC. I apologize, sir. But they talk about, it says, the provisions of paragraph C do not authorize a modification or variance except as otherwise authorized by law. What does that mean?
In C, we're talking about changing standards, doing things a little differently. I think you were here when we talked about use and development standards.
Right.
It doesn't authorize use variations. You can't really violate the law, but there's a lot of flexibility at the local level. Ginny, I think she has a comment on that.
Can I add one more thing? It doesn't authorize additional variances that local governments already don't allow. If they already do allow it, it allows those. It doesn't authorize additional variances that aren't otherwise allowed.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Over on
now we're back on page 8.
That sub 4 at line 10 down to sub 5, those are other processes that might be underway. We basically hold them off for a bit. Sub 5 talks about the contents of a claim. And basically, you fill out a form and have an appraisal.
Sorry, Sue. Representative Schrader.
Sorry about that, sir. The waiver of 120-day requirement is mentioned in here. And I assume that throughout the rest of this process, from that date forward, this 120-day waiver is in effect as long as some claims procedures going forward, whether it's an appeals process, tax magistrate, ombudsperson, whoever it might be. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Sub five, a completed claim includes an appraisal that the property owner brings in. Section 16 really gets into the claims process for determining which entity is liable. This again gets back into transferring among government entities to avoid the property owner having a lot of grief. Section 17. In sub 1,
you got a question on section 17.
Kind of a 16, kind of a comment. Does 16 make 13 redundant? You just alluded to that effect, and other than 13 kind of spelling out that if it's a state claim, it should be a state, if it's a local, it's a local, can't that also be taken care of just by Section 16?
Chair Williams, yeah.
If I could, I think what 13 does, if maybe this is a, and if I'm wrong, correct me, Sue, I think 13 essentially, Representative Schrader, sets out the standard. In other words, it says who's responsible for which type of claim. 16 is the section that essentially defines the process when there is some potential disagreement, or at least when you're actually making the claim and you go through the process where the liability is established. And the idea on 16, and whether it does it or not, is, I guess, subject to some conversation. But the idea was to not make the landowner who's now filed the claim have to be the one that spends the time going through the bureaucratic process that, you know, the claim is the claim, and then we'll let government do its thing.
Exactly correct.
Thank you, Sue. We're going to pause here at 17 because we are under call, and the Sergeant of Arms has come to usher us to the floor. And if Representative Schrader will rejoin us, we'll, after the call's over, we'll go back through the other section.
coup d'etat. Please continue, Sue.
Members of the committee, we're on Section 17 on the bill that would be found on page 9, line 8. This section calls upon the county to make an initial determination of whether the claim has any validity. You know, they're going to be checking property records and that kind of thing. Section 18 assumes we find a valid claim. That begins your process, a public hearing, basically so you can look at what you might be using in that toolbox. There'll be a final determination made over on page 10, sub 2, within 21 days of the hearing. The rest of that section deals with a bunch of details like notice and things of that nature. Section 19, and what I'll say here is we have different points of appeal. There are different bases on which you could appeal, so your appeal would go to different places. In Section 19, we talk about what if there's a disagreement over the value of the property or the value of the land development benefits. The parties can go to arbitration, and that would be binding arbitration. They can agree to do that, or they can go to the Oregon Tax Court where the matter would be referred to the magistrate's division for resolution. I have talked with the chair of the magistrate's division, and he assures me that these kinds of issues are something that they deal with on a regular basis. For people who have appeared before the local government and have some dissatisfaction with the process in Section 20, there's a writ of review. For issues that would normally go to LUBA, say there's been a development standard on a setback because some dwelling has been allowed, then the stay to LUBA would be lifted. The matter could go to LUBA. Section 21, we're changing our focus at this point to establishing the authority and the process for really handling these claims. This is where we establish within DAS, the Compensation and Conservation Authority. They'll be responsible for state administration. Section 22 puts a Citizen Oversight Board over that authority. It's the Citizen Oversight Board down at line 44 on page 11 that has the rule writing authority. Section 23 is your usual legislative council on how to do your initial terms. Section 24 gives the governor authority to appoint a director who will direct the authority. 25 sets forth the duties of the Compensation and Conservation Authority. Section 26 deals with transferable development credits. That is something that is part of the toolbox in this prospective section. Section 27 sets up the registry of the areas. I'm sorry, I think we call them districts. Let's see. If certain actions are going to be taken outside an urban growth boundary, it's going to require board action under this draft rather than just the authority. It would be the citizens' board to create a receiving area outside an urban growth boundary. Section 28 contemplates that the legislature...
Sue?
Yes, Representative Schrader.
Yes, ma'am. Move that chair to talk to you. But, you need to speed it up a little bit. No, I'm just kidding. That's plenty fast.
I told him my directions from the chair were to speed it up.
The receiving area. So in a sense, in effect here, under Section 27, that board becomes almost a superseding authority for receiving districts. Is that correct?
Chair Schrader I'd be reluctant to use the loaded term supersiding, although there are those who might view it in that respect.
So there may be some parameters upon you'd want to put around that.
There might be.
Okay. Thank you. Got another question, if I may. Back a few sections ago, I think section 21, there is established in the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. I think the authority would appear to be a pretty good idea. The question is where to house it and what expertise DAS would have with these types of issues, and I assume this is meant to be a delegatory authority on their part.
Representative Schrader, as we've discussed, we're looking at an agency that the authority would be a relatively small agency. The expertise for carrying out their duties under this act will be within the authority. There are other things they're going to have to do. They're going to have to figure out how to program their computers. Who's going to serve on the safety committee? These kinds of things can be dealt with by DAS. Rather than hiring a computer expert just for the authority, we could house them in DAS and be much more efficient with our tax dollars. That's why it's structured in this manner, but is not meant to give DAS any control over the substantive decisions of the authority.
Thank you.
Moving on to section 28, page 13. Assuming that the legislature would like to know how this is all going, we have a report to the legislature. Section 29. This creates an ombudsman. I think there were several members who expressed interest in this, that the property owners need someone to go to. Maybe when they're filing their claim, how does it work initially? What happens when they're trying to work out a resolution with the authority on the toolbox? Who can work with them? And in other provisions, we talk about working to a resolution without working to a conflict. And the ombudsman is going to be the principal in that arena. So we talked about the duties of the ombudsman, and it'll be both under the retrospective piece and the prospective piece.
Do we need to have more fleshing out of that as far as the committee goes? Do you feel that the brushstrokes here cover the areas you've just indicated and perhaps others that might come up?
Representative Schrader, you can flesh it out a bit more. You'll have to decide how much control you want to give the ombudsman, or just what duties you want. As I have it here, they're mediating and they're negotiating. And basically it says they can work in that realm. When I say sections 3, 4, and 12, well, those are the bases for the claim. It means the ombudsman can do anything in this bill that needs to be done, particularly if requested by the property owner. Section 31 is one of those dull funds being set up so we can spend the money. And I already know that I'm going to be proposing a technical amendment on this. But sub 1 is the continuing account. That's for the prospective activities. Sub 2, the reconciliation account, is to settle those early claims under 3 and 4. That reconciliation account should terminate when the bill when the sections 3 through 10 sunset. Section 32 is an appropriation. I anticipate that we'll be doing a lot more on the revenue piece with this. Section 33, this whole bill is contingent on a constitutional amendment that I have yet to see. If the chair has any more questions, I'd be happy to entertain, or any other member of the committee.
Well, I'll just make a comment. I think one of the things we would want to discuss is in Section 32, which would be the amount of startup capitalization. That's been, I think, an item people are interested in. If Florida, I think, did $5 million, as I recollect, in one of their accounts. So there's nothing biblical about this number, but it's a a starting point, perhaps, in the discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Beck.
Doing appraisals and all the grunt work is, you know, this, I didn't read this, or just assume that.
Sue.
Chair Schrader, Representative Beck, page 13, line 39, to implement the provisions of the whole act. So that would be anything from paying staff salaries to paying compensation. And I did this intentionally because I didn't have anyone to ask at the time. So I thought, okay, we're going to open this all up and they can work on it later.
And of course, in section 33, the whole document is married. It's funding plus document equals success or failure.
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to get at. Fund or an appropriation out of this legislation.
Comment.
I'm not even sure we can use bond money.
This says general fund, of course, right
but
here.
But I'm talking about the bond.
Good comment.
Yeah.
Good comment, actually.
Okay.
Operations. Okay, you know.
If I can make a general statement, we have the bill now. For those members who are interested in authorizing amendments, I will be taking them. I would stress again that Ginny and I are part-time staff. We need the amendment concepts in as early as possible. We need to know when you're going to need these amendments and with whom we can discuss the amendments. Because if Representative Minnis gives me an amendment, I'm not going to discuss it with anybody else. The same old attorney-client business. Anything else?
Okay. Representative Beck.
Would you prefer we...
Submit them just to Elsie, and Midge will go over them, and she can always be in touch with me. Okay, and I already anticipate that I'll have my own amendment of technicals. I've discovered that I didn't do the fund. There might be leftover money in the fund after the whole thing sunsets in the early part of the bill. So my amendment will be just strictly technical, really give you nap time.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Yeah, testimony. I'd ask a question of our staff as far as the constitutional piece, some rollout timeline. So. Okay. No. Thank you. Yes.
I have not seen the constitutional piece yet. It's my understanding that it should be available today or tomorrow.
With that, then, we are adjourned.